We're recording today on the lands of the Jagera people and acknowledge the traditional elders here, past and present. Hi, I'm Tim. I'm a digital marketer and small business owner.
Hello, I'm Andrea. I'm a former registered nurse and midwife in private practice and a community advocate. Welcome to Beyond the Rona. We're on a journey here to find out what are the big problems and the big solutions as we move through the pandemic.
And we're today joined by Andrew Tijan. He's a student studying social work, and he's also an organiser for SECURE, which is the acronym for the Southeast Queensland Union of Renters. Hi, Andrew. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, it's great to be chatting. This is our second episode on the topic of housing in Logan. And while SECURE, you know, obviously represents all of Southeast Queensland, probably fair to say a lot of the issues transcend the different areas within Southeast Queensland. Just looking at the site, the website for SECURE, it says that you're an organisation committed to community members who believe that the balance of forces currently sits too far in the favour of landlords and the real estate industry, and that for renters to counter this, we must organise ourselves together in a union to leverage collective strength. So I see that the organisation is quite new, founded last year. Can you tell us a bit more about the backstory and how it was actually founded?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess the starting point for the founding of the union was how dire the situation was for renters, which I think was for anyone renting or looking for a house at the time was very, very obvious. And that was also around the time when it started becoming very clear that Brisbane was going to be getting the Olympics in 2032, which is obviously always an absolute disaster for communities and renters and, anyone that isn't quite well off. So there was all of those factors kind of like bubbling below the surface. And then the way that the union kind of like formed out of that was a public meeting was called by an anarchist organization called Anarchist Communist Mianjin, which I'm also a member of, for full disclosure. So they called a public meeting on the kind of housing crisis and how tenants could kind of do something about it. There was a number of speakers that attended, including a couple of speakers from the Renting and Housing Union in Victoria. Right. So there was a long discussion on the issues facing renters and the various ways that renters have kind of confronted these issues in the past, which was, has usually been tenant unionism. And then from that public meeting, more continued to be held, discussions with, a whole range of community members that got involved early on were had, and it's pretty early agreed upon that we needed a tenants union for Queensland to face the issues that are already confronting us and to try to build up some collective strength before things like the Olympics are really on our doorstep. So from that, we started going through the long process of formally voting to form the union, putting together a constitution, websites, Facebook pages, social medias and all that. So that all took, maybe 3 months or so, I would say. And then, and then we managed to launch about midway through last year. And have been organizing ever since, which has been really great. We've got, been really amazed with the kind of how much people are like, this is amazing. This is, what tenants need. So that's been really nice. And there's nothing too exciting about how we formed, but that's often how these things do actually end up coming about.
Absolutely. And I think the timing of this is also, super important. Referencing here a realestate.com.au article, which we'll link to in the show notes, which talks about, I'll just read in a short excerpt here, which says that Brisbane's hit its tightest residential vacancy rate in 16 years. So it's 1.1%. So what that is 3,800 homes available for rent. Which was lower than December's number, which was at 1.3. So there were essentially 1,000 less rentals in January this year compared to December. And the article says that while Brisbane's 0.2 percentage point tightening was less severe than Sydney and Melbourne, the situation was still dire. And it's been translating into large surges in weekly rents. In fact, they were suggesting that rents might rise over 10% this year or even more, because in the capital cities combined, rents have already gone up 5% in 90 days. So this is obviously getting out of control. What's your immediate reaction to that?
It's pretty shocking. And, you know, the predictions of, say, a 10% rent increase over the next year has to also be added on to the fact that rents across the Southeast Queensland region have skyrocketed over the past 2 years. Like,
yes,
a lot of the Gold Coast and Sunshine Coast regions have gone up by, like, 20% over the past couple of years. And then for most other areas, it's still gone up 5%, 10% pretty much across the board. You don't speak to many tenants nowadays that don't talk about how they've got a $50 rent increase over the past year or so. So, you know, that just adds that extra 10% in a bit more context.
Yeah.
I think the other thing that I always think about when it comes to, you know, these really low vacancy rates is, you know, so we have a strong belief that at the end of the day, the main core of the tenants crisis, the rental crisis, is the imbalance of power between tenants and landlords in the real estate industry. So when you have a situation with such small vacancy rates and rent skyrocketing and it being so difficult to find a house, you have all these bidding wars and stuff like that, it means people are terrified to have to leave where they're living at, which means they will, you know, not feel like they can ask for maintenance or not feel like they can report their landlord or real estate that are breaking the rules, because they're terrified that if they do that, they'll be evicted.
Yeah.
Which, you know, landlords and real estates do often do. And then they'll be stuck, unable to find a house in this horrendous market. So it's a situation that has been great for landlords in the real estate industry. They've got to increase their profits, and it's given them an even greater stranglehold over tenants.
Mm.
And it's been a, you know, pretty big disaster for everyone else.
Yeah. I mean, obviously these surges in the rental, the price of rent is a key factor, but there are several others, right? Like I was just looking back, and another thing that we can link to in the notes was the bill from last year that Amy McMahon had put up in state government, and that was to address and put a cap on rental prices. I mean, if we just look at that particular issue around potentially capping the amount of rent increases that can happen in a year, and also capping the amount that it can go up by so that it's in line with inflation. Do you see that as a solution to that particular problem around rent increases?
I think rent caps, you know, I think they can help a lot. That's not something I've researched into a lot, but I would rather a situation where there are rent caps where, you know, landlords can't just charge what they want and it's not all at the dictate of the market. I think that would, you know, go some way in solving the issues facing renters. And there's a lot of other things as well, you know, like Queensland has some of the worst tenancy laws in the developed world, like the worst in Australia. But if you compare it to Europe and America, it's far below what you generally see. Right. Like, you know, leases being 6 months, usually the terrible eviction laws, all of that. So it's shocking across the board. So things like rent caps, I think, are, you know, very important. Then you also, like, I think extending leases so that the minimum isn't 6 months or a year, like, mm-hmm. you know, 2 years, 5 years. In some places in Europe, you have 10-year leases where the tenants can leave whenever they want, but they can't be evicted by the landlord in that 10 years. Like, stuff like that.
Yeah.
I think, you know, all of these things are important to providing, you know, renters with stability, security, affordability. The important thing is how we, you know, how do we actually get those reforms? It's pretty obvious that, you know, we can't expect landlords or real estate agents to be kind to us, because at the end of the day, it's not in their interests.
Mm-hmm.
And politicians aren't going to do it out of the goodwill of their heart either.
Yeah.
So if we want to see any of these improvements, you know, the question is building a tenants movement that can actually force the government to make meaningful reforms.
And so government, on just on that point, and in fact, I thought, just looking at the site again, I thought it was interesting that, that kind of idea of rejecting, you know, using the union's energy to achieve change through elections or politician route or parties. So that kind of like apolitical approach, but applying pressure to the government of the day So government's still the mechanism that can do that, but the union's collective action then applies pressure on government to make those changes? Would you put it that way?
Yeah. I mean, I'd never say that, you know, an approach that rejects, say, aligning with a specific political party or something like that, I don't think makes it apolitical. I think it's still very political.
Yeah. Yeah.
But even then, like, you know, I think it's obvious that renters we can't come together and build 100,000 public housing properties. But when change does happen, like, just because it's a politician that's, you know, signed the piece of paper, they're not going to do that out of the goodwill of their heart. Like, in history showing this, like, big reforms, big changes have always stemmed from powerful mass movements fighting on the ground, fighting from below. Yes. And not doing that to get ex-politician elected, but doing that to force whoever's elected to concede to their demands. Like, some of the biggest changes we've seen over the last 100 years has actually been won from conservative governments.
Right.
Which kind of, you know, speaks to that.
Yeah.
We're not apolitical, but our concern is building power of tenants directly, not hoping we can get the right politician in and then hopefully they help us.
Yeah. No, good point. And some of those other issues. So some of the other issues facing renters. I mean, whilst I grew up in Logan, I actually rented in Sydney for a long period of time, over 10 years. And rent bidding was, I don't know whether it is still these days, since now that I'm back in Logan, but rent bidding at the time was almost a given, because you would go there and go to a property and there's so many people and you realize, if I have any chance of securing this place, I'm going to have to write a number that's higher than the advertised rent price.
I have had friends do that here in the Logan area. They have told me about that. I've had a family with three children, twins who are two-year-olds and a five-year-old child. And, they had to offer over the rental amount by, you know, at least $20, maybe $50 a week, you know, and they can't afford to pay extra money than what the going rent is. So this is how the rent is rising. I mean, I don't have to tell you anything about this, Andrew, but you know, they can't afford this extra $20 a week. You know, people think that you can, but a family who's doing it tough, they can't afford that. So in the end, they had to move in to her parents' dining room, you know, which obviously doesn't have a door on it, but the entire family had to move into the parents' dining room because there wasn't anywhere to rent.
Yeah, shocking.
It's very common at the moment. Like, you know, because I don't know if either of you have moved recently. I know I did. And it was really wild when I had to move rentals for the first time since COVID, because you're used to seeing maybe three or four other people at an inspection, and all of a sudden you're confronted with 20, 30 people.
Right.
Which has led to, rent bidding. Like, it's also led to, you know, people maybe offering, like, oh, I'll pay you 6 months or a year's worth of rent up front. Wow. And I heard this from one of our members, actually, who are also recently looking, you know, and they were looking for a long time. And they were talking to one of the real estate agents after one, and they were like, look, I've been looking for so long. Like, what do I need to do to get a property? Like, what do I need to do to get this?
Mm.
And the real estate agent was like, well, it's very competitive right now, so you have to be competitive. And a member was like, well, what does that mean? They were like, well, you know, offer more than everyone else. Offer this much up front, which I might be wrong on this, but I'm pretty sure real estate agents aren't actually legally meant to be doing this.
Yes.
But they absolutely are. This is a horrible situation, which is bad for everybody. But the people that are particularly going to be affected are the people that are less financially well off, you know, people with large families, people that can't afford to like Andrea said, spend $20 more a week or have the savings to pay 12 months rent up front. So, and then, like, so homelessness of families particularly has really skyrocketed.
Mm.
And then, like I said, now you just have a situation where everyone's so terrified of having to move because of the situation.
Yeah.
And it's also based on, you know, other factors as well, because this particular family was Islander and they felt that they were like put down the bottom of the list because they were Islander, and because they had young children. They didn't have any pets, but, you know, what your race is and whether you have young children really added to whether, you know, you were put at the bottom of the list for whether you got a property. You know, it was other factors. So if you were a professional couple who didn't have children and didn't have pets, you had much more
And I guess, properties open Andrew, to on the you. Point you make about the pandemic, I mean, that's absolutely exacerbated the situation. You can kind of see that in the numbers objectively, but we've also just had a flood. So can you tell us about, I guess, yeah, some of the members who've been affected directly by that, and also what the emergency housing response was?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, the floods have only added to the kind of turmoil that renters are going through at the moment. Like, we've spoken to a lot of people that, you know, have got in contact with us and are like, look, our property was completely flooded. We can't live in it at the moment. We're currently living in a hotel or living in this like shelter or whatever. But our landlord is insisting that we pay the full $800 rent a week. They won't give us a reduction. They won't give us a waiver. Because technically that's up to the landlord. To, from the kindness of their heart, either give them a reduction or a waiver or say no. Some landlords have, you know, had a bit of human compassion and done that, but far more haven't.
Right.
Because there's nothing that says that they have to, and it's in their interest to continue getting paid. Then you also have the situation where, according to the legislation, if, you know, during a flood or whatever, a house gets hit, it can be deemed unlivable. I'm not exactly sure what the process is of it being deemed unlivable, but the landlord can deem it unlivable and then can give you 24 hours to vacate the property. So obviously, if you've just been hit by a flood, most of your possessions are destroyed, and then you're then told that you have to get out in 24 hours, that's a pretty terrible situation, particularly when you already know that, well, the rental market is the way that it is. How am I going to find somewhere to live? So that's pretty horrible. And there's nothing that makes the, like, real estates, for example, help somebody get a property in that situation or provides any support. In this specific case, I believe the government has been giving people about $1,000. I'm not sure if that's directly tied to the rental stuff or just what the government is giving for flood impacted people, but there's been at least a little bit of support as far as that goes. But even then, with when you look at the actual scale of what people are going through and how much it costs to move and how you probably would have to move all your possessions into like storage and find a hotel because you're not going to find a place in 24 hours. Even $1,000 isn't very much. So there's little safety net for renters when confronted by, you know, a natural disaster like this, which we live in Brisbane. It was built on a floodplain. The climate crisis is only growing. So this isn't going to be the last time. So that's, I think, something that we're probably going to keep coming up against unless, you know, we force some actual change around it.
Yeah. And Andrew, we have a whole lot of people in Logan who would need a lot of help filling out those forms to get any help in the first place. You know, our multicultural communities are, you know, they're pretty massive in Logan. So you would think that, like, landlord groups or, you know, maybe the real estate agents would be helping people to access.
You'd like to think so, but I'd be very doubtful
in that situation.
I mean, the crux of it is, like, real estate industry exists to, you know, take money from renters and give it to landlords and stop that going the other way as much as possible. They don't really give a hoot about tenants or what happens to them, unfortunately. Although something I found out the other day is apparently the REIQ, so the Rental Real Estate Industry Institute of Queensland, is apparently started to tell landlords that have Airbnbs that they should begin converting them into private rentals to ease pressure on the rental market. Now, I don't know how much is that just doing that as a propaganda point to be like, no, we're doing something here, but they're not actually trying to do that. Or, you know, how much of that is true or not, but that is something that they said on the news, which, you know, I I'm not going to give them any applause for that, but still be making $700 a week off the exploitation of tenants. But that's something I have seen from them, of like trying to do something.
And in terms of, like, I guess other organizations, I mean, here in Queensland, the Residential Tenancies Authority, you know, is a government body, right? They get government. Is that correct? They're a government entity. Is that
your understanding? Yeah, I believe they're essentially akin to like the Fair Work Commission.
Like, yeah, okay. What is your take on what the RTA can do for tenants?
Yeah, I think that's a good question, because I think people often have a really big misunderstanding about what the RTA is. Uh-huh. I think people tend to think the RTA is this thing that exists to help tenants out, and it's kind of on the tenant side and stuff. It's really not what it's for. The RTA exists to kind of monitor bonds and to, you know, I think on their website they say that they want to make renting work for both parties or something like that, which means, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I view, like I said, the RTA is very similar to the Fair Work Commission as something that's set up to provide the air of neutrality and equality of both parties, but actually only exists to benefit the party that actually, you know, has power, in this case, the landlords and the real estate industry. So it's not really, I think, a massive vehicle for change. And like I said, it mostly exists around bonds, really. Like, if you have, say, an issue around evictions or whatever, that doesn't so much go through the RTA, but it'll end up going to, like, QCAT and things like that. And then I think people often think that you can get advice from the RTA.
Yeah.
It's not really the case. If you're a tenant and you're looking for legal advice, you're much better off getting in contact with Tenants Queensland's tenant advice hotline, which is called QSTARS.
QSTARS, yeah.
Mind you, that's quite, I think, overwhelmed at the moment with everything happening. So sometimes you can wait, but yeah.
Can tenants, like, how do they get involved with Secure, or can they reach out to Secure, or is it more about becoming a member and then joining that collective action?
Yeah. So, I mean, if people want to reach out, they can reach out through our website or our Facebook. We do get a lot of people reaching out for legal advice, which, as a rule, we generally recommend that they go to QSTARS, just because that's not so much our forte, and this resource already does exist that can make sure that they do it correctly. Like, we don't want to be in a situation of giving somebody the wrong legal advice or anything.
Yeah.
So we're much more focused on, like, you know, so QSTARS and Tenants Queensland do that kind of advocacy work and that legal advice. Whereas, yeah, we're much more focused on kind of providing a home for tenants to collectively organize together to work out what they want and to kind of fight and organize and struggle to get that.
Yeah, great. Andrea mentioned, some of the kind of specific challenges that also come with, you know, with the Logan community, where there's a whole bunch of different ethnic backgrounds and also diverse language competency with English. And so, yeah, some of the challenges in, you know, even reaching out and educating renters as to what their rights are, what they can do, is something that's kind of exacerbated in Logan. But to even add to that, there's also Logan is kind of seen as a growth corridor, and the council and state government have planned for 27,000 new homes in the kind of southern area of Logan, particularly around Flagstone and across to Yarrabilba in the east. So there's planning and development underway for all of these new homes, which invariably are going to, some of which will obviously be rentals. How do you see an increase like that in both kind of, stock, but also more people coming into the region, potentially from interstate?
Yeah, I mean, one thing, just whenever you have a mass influx of people, there's always a big question of, will there be investment in infrastructure to keep up with that? Like, for example, I'm from the Sunshine Coast originally. which was constantly growing massively.
Yeah.
But there was never any effort made to increase the public transport or anything like that, which, you know, made it a terrible place to live in. So there's always that question whenever, you know, the state government's like, oh, we're going to get 50,000 more people. This is great. Well, you know, is that stuff going to keep up? Is it going to continue being livable for the people there?
Yeah.
And then there's also the question of, like, I mean, with the way that things are going, you'd always say, like, look, more houses is probably better than if everyone just refused to build. But, you know, most of these that are rentals and not just home owner-occupied are going to be private rentals, which isn't going to provide renters really with any greater affordability or housing stability and security. It's not going to change the exploitative and unbalanced relationship between tenants and landlords.
Mm-hmm.
And it's likely, I would imagine, to still just increase prices, like rental prices in Logan.
Yeah.
As, because, like I said, like so many people are getting forced out of, say, the Sunshine Coast and Gold Coast and Brisbane. So a lot of them are now looking to, all right, well, Logan's more affordable, we'll move to Logan. And that's going to increase prices to Logan as well, in the same way that Brisbane's increased because everyone's come from Sydney and Melbourne. So I think if you wanted to, you know, if we're talking about, like, well, we need to build so many more houses in a way that benefits tenants, then I think we have to be talking about public housing. Like, you know, if there was 50,000 public housing being built, that wasn't just going to be provided just to the worst off. Like, you know, because it's good to keep in mind that public housing wasn't originally designed to just be for the really worse off in society. It was meant to be for most people.
Right.
Like, if you look at Scotland, for example, 80% of their rental market is public housing, and only about 20% is private housing. And not many people own their houses there.
Uh-huh.
Because public housing is affordable. You pretty much get to control what you do with it. So, you know, if we change our idea of what public housing is, and then actually fight and organize for public housing, then I think that is when you'd, you know, start seeing some benefits from 50,000 more places being built or whatever.
And are you seeing, just on that point, are you seeing that erosion of available public housing still? Like the actual number of available is dropping, and meanwhile the wait list is super long, isn't it? Is that?
Yeah, I don't know the specific numbers for it, but I do. I have like a bunch of family currently on the wait list for public housing, and it's shocking. Like, you can be on that wait list for years.
Right.
It's really bad, particularly if you have, say, like certain needs about it, like, oh, I can't go upstairs, for example. I think every so often the government might talk about they're going to build 500 more public housing, which is nothing when you look at the wait list. And with COVID and everything, where everyone is getting economically more worse off, people are not able to work, so people are struggling more, so public housing has more need. It's public housing's in a shocking state and really has been all across Australia for a long time.
Yeah.
Which I think is a purposeful thing of when the government kind of shifted, gutted the public housing structure, and then tried to reframe it from this kind of social good to this horrible thing for horrible people.
Yeah, but then we have like public housing for, you know, army people, and that's not a horrible thing. It's not seen as a horrible thing. So, you know, it's strange that there's that contradiction.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, the government and the other powers that be put a lot of effort into constructing how people view and think about these things. There's a reason why you still have most people look at, say, a homeless person and go, oh, bloody hell, look at this layabout, rather than, wow, this is horrible that, you know, capitalism and all of these structures have created this.
Yeah.
Because they put millions of dollars into making people think like that. Like, I don't think it's a case of people are bad for doing it. It's, you know, a lot of money's made into doing that.
So we need an increase, like, we need government policy that will bring an increase in public housing, but we also need government policy that will bring an increase in rental stock. At the moment, we have government policy that's trying to help people own their own home, which is probably going to decrease the rental stock that's available, because people are going to buy those properties and then they're going to, you know, it's going to take more rentals off the market.
If for me, I would argue that, look, I don't think creating more landlords is ever a good thing. I think we want to be creating less landlords. and whether that is, you know, ideally, you know, if you, people getting their own homes would be wonderful. And then, you know, public and social housing. Like, I don't think that creating more landlords is necessarily the solution. Now, in saying that, I wouldn't, you know, that's not like an official union policy or anything.
Right. And sure.
I'm not saying that, you know, more houses being rented out is a bad thing because we desperately need it. But I would never kind of look at like, well, adding to this exploitative relationship is a pathway out of the exploitative relationship.
Yeah. So have you got any ideas for how we would get landlords to put solar on rentals?
I mean, if you want to get landlords to say put solar panels on, I think, you know, the best argument is usually like, hey, man, this will increase your property value. You know, if you want landlords to do stuff like that, I think you usually have to go for the thing that they care about, which is, you know, money and how much their property's worth. And then I think like...
Yeah.
You know, I mean, at the moment, it's impossible for most tenants to get their landlords to install fans or air conditioning to deal with the Queensland summer, let alone something like solar paneling.
Yeah.
So I think, but in a, you know, I think a good...
Yeah.
A situation where tenants had a lot of strength and a big mass movement, you could be looking at, you know, as a part of the various reforms that this movement's trying to win or conquer, adding stuff of like, well, no, you have to pay for water. Or no, you have to pay for electricity. And once you do that, I'm pretty sure they'd install solar paneling pretty quickly.
Right. Mm. Yeah, so swapping over the responsibility to the landlord again. Because it used to be, did it ever be that way? I'm not sure. So like you say, there is that power imbalance that the tenants are becoming more and more disempowered.
Which, aren't they? You know, is for us, why you gotta unionize, you gotta join your union.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a great call to action. I think definitely we're going to link all of Secure's website and socials here on the show notes. But one other question, Andrew, because this podcast, we started this podcast during the pandemic, and so just interested in your thoughts pandemic-wise, like what, certainly it seems like people in affected industries with the pandemic, initially the hospitality, tourism, and all of those kind of frontline service careers were also disproportionately likely to rent and likely to be young. And so the pandemic had a really, really kind of overly negative impact on those who were renting. Would you classify it that way? And also, where are we now? Where do you see us now? 2 years later, has things improved?
Yeah. No, I think you're definitely right in, you know, that kind of view of things. Like, most like hospitality workers generally, as a, you know, somebody that worked in hospitality a long time myself, you work hospitality, you live in a share house, usually a pretty crappy share house that has still surprisingly high rent.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, like, you know, everyone was forced out of work for huge amounts of time. And it was pretty dire. And, you know, I was kind of involved with the rent strike movement, like early on in the pandemic, which didn't really go anywhere for various reasons. We're probably a bit, you know, there were some mistakes made there, but there was, you know, I think that was important though, because there were so many people that were out of work and were they're like, well, I'm going to be evicted in the middle of this pandemic. Obviously rent, eviction kind of were halted for a while and stuff. And that was a positive, but you know, evictions are back up and running again. And now you have a situation where COVID itself is obviously still running rampant, but the government's not going to act on it anymore. It's not going to bring in lockdowns or anything like that, which in a sense, I think is worse. Like in an ideal world, I'd like to see lockdowns, but where employers are forced to pay their workers' wages, whether they're casual or not.
Right.
Instead of, you know, the situation where, well, you know, if you're a hospitality worker and you got to go to work, you got to risk getting COVID. Maybe you have COVID, but for various reasons, you feel like you have to go into work anyway because your boss is forcing you to.
Right.
Or because you can't take that week off work because if you do that, you might not be able to afford your rent.
Exactly.
I don't think COVID's going anywhere soon. And I think it's still going to continue impacting like the massive influx of migration to Queensland that's going to continue raising rents, that's going to continue eroding renters' rights, and then that's going to continue kind of, you know, I think if you look at it, like, it's not just the southeast corner that's going through this in Queensland, like Cairns and North Queensland's kind of starting to go through the same thing. Even some really regional towns like out west that you wouldn't think of at all are going through this process now. So,
yeah. Well, I guess then on this point, I know that it paints a bit of a dire picture, but how we end this is we always ask our guests what their three big ideas are. So specifically, like, you know, we covered a lot of topics here, but of all of these challenges, what do you think are the three things that we need to do to improve the rental situation and improve rental rights?
Yeah, I really like that for ending the talk. I think this is a good way to do it. I think the most important one, and I've kind of alluded to this all throughout, is that if we want to see change, whatever that change is, you know, the tenants do have shared interests. Those interests are opposed to what the interests of the landlords and real estate industry are. So, you know, when tenants come together, we discuss what our interests are. We work out what we want to improve, what we think we need. And then we start organizing together. We start acting in solidarity together, and we start fighting together, and we start building a movement. Then we can actually start seeing meaningful changes for tenants, whether that's rent caps or more public housing or increased leases, whatever it is. That's how we can win them. And while we're winning them, we can teach each other about renters' rights. We can, you know, help support each other. We can help each other stand up when our real estates and landlords are being dodgy. So, yeah, if we want to see change and we want to improve things for tenants, then tenants have to organize and we have to do it ourselves.
Yeah.
Because no one else is going to do it for us.
Yeah.
So that's one big idea.
So that's one.
But to be honest,
excellent.
If I did two other big ideas, it would probably just be me saying that again in slightly different words. That's the second big idea.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. Or the classic
organize,
or something like that. Join your union. If you're listening and you're not in, like, Southeast Queensland, in Victoria, there's also a tenants union.
Yeah.
If you're somewhere where there isn't, get in contact with the tenants unions that exist. We can help you set one up.
Yeah.
It's pretty easy and it's pretty great. And it's, you know, this is how we can fight.
Excellent.
That's great. No, well done, Andrew. No, it's really good. And
excellent.
Yeah, thank you to you and everyone in Insecure for the work that you do to improve the situation for renters. And yeah, we can certainly see that there's big challenges ahead, more pressure being applied to the industry through all this growth. And keep up the good fight. Thank you so much for coming on Beyond the Rona.
Yeah, thank you so much to both of you for having me. This has been really great and a really good chat. And yeah, I really appreciate it. Thank you both.
Awesome. And thank you, Andrea. Thanks as always.
Thanks, Andrew. It's great to meet you.
You've been listening to Beyond the Rona. Caption audio is available on our YouTube channel.
Thanks, Tim. And
don't forget to visit beyondtherona.com to listen to previous episodes or get in touch. Catch you next time.